From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Michael Chiklis, the star of the FX series The Shield. He plays Vic Mackey, a rogue cop who leads a strike team in LA's inner city. The series won a Peabody Award last year, and Chiklis has won an Emmy and a Golden Globe for his portrayal of Mackey. Also, country music songwriter Bobby Braddock tells us about writing George Jones's hit He Stopped Loving Her Today and Tammy Wynette's D-I-V-O-R-C-E. Braddock has a new memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Look, let's get this straight. We need the truth. This thing's going to get a lot uglier before it gets better.
Things are definitely getting uglier this season for Detective Vic Mackey on the FX series The Shield. My guest Michael Chiklis plays Mackey, the leader of the strike team which works LA's inner city streets, busting drug dealers, gang members, and killers. The strike team is fearless and committed, but they're also corrupt. They've stolen drug money, they've beaten confessions out of people, and two of them have killed other cops. The Shield won a Peabody Award last spring. The citation said, "No cop series has posed harder questions than The Shield about how far we're willing to go to let law enforcement officers go to keep us safe." Chiklis has won an Emmy and a Golden Globe for his portrayal of Vic Mackey. The Shield is in its sixth season. Last week was a turning point. Mackey had been investigating who killed Lem, a member of his strike team. Finally, Mackey figured out it was Shane, another member of the team, who was afraid that Lem was going to confess to the strike team's crimes and land them all in jail. Here's Mackey confronting Shane, played by Walton Goggins.
"You killed my friend, and then you almost let Kavanaugh send me away for it."
"I never would have let it come to that."
"You let me kill Guardo without opening your damn mouth. I had the chance to pull the trigger on you once before. I didn't do it. And Lem lost his life because of it."
"Lem would have broken. I took it on myself, the way that you took it off of us for Terry. Like, you're gonna learn to be okay with it. Man, you just need a little time."
"You and me, we're all out of time." "Lem's case still open. I hope they catch you. I hope they do. I hope everybody knows what you did. You don't get to do what you did for free. You're gonna pay that bill."
Before Mackey figured out that Shane killed Lem, Mackey tortured Guardo, the man he thought had done it, trying to get information out of him. Mackey strung him up and beat him with a chain, and when there was no confession, Mackey shot him. I asked Michael Chiklis what it was like to film such a brutal scene.
From a playing standpoint, it can be quite miserable, to tell you the truth, Terry. I mean, you know, you're in a room for 12 hours with an actor that you really, really like hanging by a chain, and you're slashing him with albeit a fake chain, but, you know, you want to make it viable and everything. And it's all about a trust exercise and as actors being able to give each other permission. And I think that I'm really, really happy that I have the training that I do, because if you don't have that fundamental foundation, it would be very easy to sort of carry this type of material around with you in your day-to-day life. And you really can't afford to do that. You have to be able to compartmentalize and realize that, you know, between action and cut, you have to be honest, open, available, and touch that pool of emotion and go there. And then when you hear cut, you have to let it go.
How does it affect, say, for instance, in this scene, the relationship that you have with the actor that you're torturing? And you're torturing him because you want information about who else was in on this. And he's not giving anything up because he's not the guilty person. But anyways, how does this affect your relationship with that actor? Do you feel, you know, bad about putting him through it? Well, do you ask him every often in between takes, is this okay for you? Am I hurting you?
Yes, it's fraught with apologies. And, you know, it really is. You just can't help but look at a guy and just go, "Oh, man, listen, for what is about to happen to you, I am truly sorry," you know, what you're about to go through. And, I mean, like I said, you have to... It's a weird sort of bonding where you're excited as actors because you know the material is great. And there's a potential, at least before you even start shooting, for a great piece of drama.
Do you have like a safe word? So if things, do you know what I mean? Of
well,
something?
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes it depends. Yes. It depends on the scene. I don't recall exactly what it was on that scene, but yes, you have safe words. You can just say, usually it's stop, you know, but sometimes the guy, it would sound too much like in the context of the scene. So he'll say, usually it comes in the form of saying the real actor's name, you know, they'll say like, Chiklis, stop, you know, and that'll jar you and go, wait, okay, now we're in the real world here, you know. I mean, listen, when you're doing something that's so documentary style and so raw and you want to go for the real, again, it's a fine line and you really have to never lose sight. You know, look, if I'm playing a murderer and I'm supposed to, you know, kill someone in a scene, well, certainly I'm not going to go and kill them. That's insanity. So you have to, you know, you have to create those barriers before you even start.
How familiar were you with the multi-ethnic inner city streets of L.A. that Vic Mackey works?
Oh, I wasn't really, honestly. That's been a big eye opener for me. I'm, you know, I knew a little bit about it because I was involved with, and have been involved with the Children's Life Saving Foundation, which I'm the spokesperson for, which is a wonderful charity that helps with children who are in homeless shelters in the Los Angeles County area. So I had been to shelters. I had visited certain areas, but we shoot in some of the hardest core neighborhoods in Los Angeles, whether it's in Rampart or East LA or in Compton. And, you know, I really didn't know that there were places like this in the United States of America, that there a downright third world, you know, just abject poverty. And it's been a very eye-opening experience, and you find yourself really, really appalled. And I find myself, you know, oftentimes driving, you know, into my beautiful home and, you know, looking at my wife and children and just having such a far more deeper respect and appreciation of the world and my life and so many things.
So you actually shoot on location?
Yes. 99% of my show is in location. We have one working set, which originally was on location as well. It was the church, which was converted into a precinct. That was originally, you know, in the pilot, that is a live location. But they replicated it on a soundstage, and that's the only, like, stationary set that we have. Everything else, pretty much, we shoot on location.
So are people who are on the inner city streets cooperative when you're shooting there? Are there crowds like around the barriers?
Yeah, well, you know, they've become very, very used to us at this point. And, you know, we use so many of the locals as background and, you know, gang members as guest stars. And, you know, the casting of the show, you know, Barbara Ferrantino and the girls have just been incredible with this show because they've gone out of their way to make it feel realer than real. And I love the fact that no one makes any hay about how diverse our show is because it feels visceral and real as opposed to being forced and sort of uncomfortable. But as far as the neighborhood's concerned, I mean, when we first started shooting down there, we had a couple of odd encounters where, you know, one night we had a crew from a major L.A. gang show up and say, hey, what are you doing here? We were like, we're shooting. And they said, oh, no, you're not. You haven't paid rent, you know. So we had to work out a little arrangement and get permission to shoot there.
Do you ever have to worry that because you are so kind of brazen and strong and tough in the show that people who want to show how tough they are will pick a fight with you?
Well, there has been the odd occasion. I have to say, first of all, 99.999% of the time, people are incredible when they approach me, whether it's about The Shield or another piece of work that I've done. But there is that odd, you know, encounter where, yeah, a guy will want to be the guy who kicks my butt, you know, and I've learned how to really diffuse that situation very easily, which is basically to say, you're right, you could. You know, I'm not going to get into an argument about that because that's when it turns into, you know, a physical altercation. I'm not going to have that happen. I'm just going to say, yeah, you're right, man, you could pummel me. and I just give it up, and it usually diffuses a situation. I start telling jokes. I think there's really, you know, oftentimes there's a way out of that kind of a encounter. But, I, you know, it rarely ever happens. You know, one or two times it's really happened where someone wanted to hang that on their hat.
My guest is Michael Chiklis, the star of the FX series The Shield. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Chiklis, the star of the FX series The Shield. He plays Detective Vic Mackey. You've directed several episodes of The Shield in addition to starring in the series. First of all, I want to play a scene from an episode that you directed. And this is a scene, you're not in this scene. This is a scene where, Captain Aceveda has been raped. Was forced to perform sex on the guy who raped him.
Yeah.
And he's very, broken up and ashamed about it. He hasn't told his wife. His wife knows that something's wrong because he hasn't been behaving like a husband. And there's a scene in which she confronts him, and he just kind of breaks down and confesses. And she doesn't accept it. She doesn't accept that he allowed this rape to happen.
Yeah.
It's a terrific scene. Can you talk about directing it? It's a really important turning point in the character of Captain Aceveda.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you have to be particularly sensitive to the actor's process. A lot of it boils down to trust. If your actors really know that you're on their side and you want them to flourish and you want them to be able to be accessible and touch that pool of emotion. I mean, that's a very, very deep scene, and it doesn't take the turn that one might expect it to. When you have someone like Benito Martinez, who's a, you know, very heterosexual, proud father and husband, having to sort of face that potential sort of humiliation and rejection, you have to talk to him and allow him to feel comfortable enough to touch that pool and go to that place. It's a very ugly, dark place.
So can you talk about what you did to make everybody feel safe to get out these emotions, or what advice, if any, you gave the actors in this scene?
With Benny, I just basically said to him, "Hey, Benny, I know this is tough, man, but you got to go there." And he knew it. And I said, "Listen, we're going to be here till we get it. So just know that, don't feel any pressure like that you have to get it in a few takes here. You know, just, do what you need to do and get to the place you need to get to." And that allows an actor to go, okay, look, 9 times out of 10, that'll give an actor enough latitude to go through their process and get where they need to go.
So why don't we hear that scene from an episode of The Shield directed by Michael Chiklis. And this is Benito Martinez as Captain Aceveda and Camille Sands as his wife. And she's about to find out that he was raped.
"Those guys I fought, one of them assaulted me."
"But you're okay now."
"They tied my hands. They made me get on my knees."
"They made you? Both of them?"
"Just one of them."
"You didn't?" "Oh. Hey, you're a cop. You're trained."
"No, I was alone. I was
No, David. How could you let that happen?
Because I wanted to live. I wanted to live for you and Sophia.
I can't talk about this here.
It's a scene from The Shield, directed by my guest Michael Chiklis, who plays Detective Vic Mackey on the series. He's the star of the show. Do you get to choose which episodes you're going to direct?
Well, usually it's determined by, you know, what really works. Because I have the, you know, the sort of added responsibility of being the lead of the show, we have to put it at in a place where I'll have the maximum amount of prep time and time to edit. And usually it comes, you know, right before a hiatus. And then I end up giving up my hiatus. You know, there's a week of hiatus, and
right.
I end up in the editing booth for that hiatus period. So, you know, schedule dictates it to a degree. And then the guys always tend to, you know, have something where, you know, something that's very emotionally volatile, you know, because they know I'm, you know, they sort of think of me as an actor's director, because the actors will feel a level of comfort with me. And, you know, like, for instance, this year it was show 5, the one where Walton Goggins' character confesses to his wife that he murdered Lem. You know, I tend to get those sort of very emotionally volatile moments where something really, really raw comes out, which I love. It's great.
Your father ran a hair salon or a barbershop?
Yeah.
Which was it? Was it
a beauty salon?
Beauty salon,
yeah.
for women.
Unisex.
Unisex.
It was unisex beauty salon.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He, you know, he's a very interesting guy. My father. He's very sort of macho kind of a guy. Very old school, New England Greek guy by heritage. That is, American by birth, by the way, and he got into styling at a time where, you know, Jack Kerouac was a cat, you know, and the Beat Generation in Lowell, Massachusetts, you know. So, you know, being into style was like a, you know, it was a cool thing, you know. And he just became successful at it. And at one point he had a few shops, and then, you know, now he's just got the one, and he's primarily retired at this point. He's sort of semi-retired and just watches the books.
Does he approve of you shaving your head?
Well, you know, what he didn't approve of is what I did to my hair. When I, little anecdote here, I played a 65-year-old man in college, Mr. DePina, in You Can't Take It With You, and I shaved my head in male patent baldness at 20 years old. And instead of being smart and using powder on my head, I used Ben Nye grease paint like I did on my face, and didn't remove it properly. I would just use soap and water, and it essentially killed the follicles on my head. So
my hair
never grew back the same. Yeah, it was a very traumatic experience as a young actor, and it actually kind of was shaped my career in a lot of ways. It's interesting what happened.
Because you had
me.
An older man's hair.
Yeah.
Line.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, yeah. So I was sort of forced to, you know, either start wearing hair pieces, which I did in Wired. I wore a hair piece on top of my head during Wired, ironically enough, or to sort of just be the person that I was. And, you know, and that's what I wore. I wore my hair normally, you know, on the commission. It was really just a train wreck of a hair situation for me. And it was very traumatic for a while, but, you know, I have no regrets, because it very much shaped my career, which has been very sort of interesting and eclectic, and mm-hmm, I'm glad.
Mm-hmm. So how do you think you're going to feel when The Shield ends?
Oh, you had to ask me that question. You know, right now it's like the 5 stages of death. I'm in denial at the moment. You know, I'm really, yeah. I have to be in denial, because I actually have to put my best foot forward and really do the best work that I can come up with for this coming year.
Yeah.
But I know it's going to be very, very hard. It's going to be very sad. Again, it's been one of the most extraordinary experiences in my life. And, You know, one thing that I can say that I'm really happy about is that it's not going to be a situation where I wake up 10 years from now and go, wow, I really didn't appreciate what that was when it was happening.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I'm very proud of is that my wife and I have known from day one what this was and how great it's been and how sweet it's been. And you know what? I don't want to be a person to move forward in my life and sort of rest on that laurel. I'm so thrilled to move forward. I feel like there's so many wonderful characters to play. And I'm really, really actually excited at the Brave New World aspect of it.
I'll be really sorry to see The Shield end. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, Terry, thank you. Right back at you.
Michael Chiklis stars in the FX series The Shield. A new episode will be shown tonight. This summer, Chiklis will star in the movie Fantastic Four: Rise of the Silver Surfer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Logoria, a collection of tales from imaginative storytellers edited by John Klima. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, during National Foster Care Month, promoting lifelong family connections for all kids in foster care. At aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Mama never had a flower.
Coming up, country music songwriter Bobby Braddock. His hits include He Stopped Loving Her Today, D-I-V-O-R-C-E, and this song, recorded by Tanya Tucker.
Daddy never went on a vacation. He died a tired old man at 44. Our neighbors in the big house called us redneck, 'cause we lived in a poor sharecropper shack. The Jacksons down the road were poor like we were, but our skin was white and theirs was black. But I believe the South is gonna rise again, but not the way we thought it would back then.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. George Jones's hit, He Stopped Loving Her Today, Tanya Tucker's I Believe the South is Gonna Rise Again, and Toby Keith's I Want to Talk About Me were all written by my guest Bobby Braddock. He was inducted into the Nashville Hall of Fame in 1981. After decades of lyric writing, he's written a memoir about growing up in old Florida called Down in Auburndale. Let's start with a Braddock song that was a number one country hit for Tammy Wynette in 1968.
Our little boy is 4 years old and quite a little man, so we spell out the words we don't want him to understand, like T-O-Y or maybe S-U-R.
P-R-E-R-I-S-E. But the words we're hiding from him now tear the heart right out of me. Our D-I-V-O-R-C-E becomes final today. Me and little J-O-B will be going away. I love you both and this will be pure A-G-double-L for me. That we could stop this D-I-V-O-R-C-E.
Bobby Braddock, welcome to Fresh Air. So tell us the story behind this song. How did you write it?
D-I-V-O-R-C-E? I had written a song called I-L-O-V-E-Y-O-U. Do I have to spell it out for you? And it wasn't very good. And that sort of inspired this song. And I wrote it. Nobody recorded it. I asked my friend Curly Putman why did he think no one had recorded it. And he said he thought the melody was a little bit too happy for a sad song. And I said, what would you do? And he got around the title line and just made it sound real mournful. And mine sounded sort of like a detergent commercial. And I said, hey, let's get it on tape like that. And he didn't want any of it. And I wanted him to have half. So we compromised and he took a quarter of it. And Tammy Wynette recorded it within, I'd say, probably a week or two after that.
Can you sing us the more upbeat version that you originally wrote?
Okay, what I had was, everything else was the same except the title line. I had, oh, I wish that we could stop this D-I-V-O-R-C-E. And Curly changed it to, I wish that we could stop this D-I-V-O-R-C-E. Which made it a lot better. And that little change made the difference, I think, between it being a hit and just gathering cobwebs and nobody ever having heard it.
Let's talk about another of your most famous songs, a song recorded by George Jones, He Stopped Loving Her Today. And after we talk about it a little bit, we'll hear it. Now, this song tells a story. Would you describe the story?
It's a story of a man who whose love was so strong that only way he could get over this woman was to die. I think he was a terrible role model. A very bad role model. The man was obsessed with this woman, and he never got over, he never moved on. Then we wrote with, again, this is one I wrote with Curly Putman. And I thought it was just an okay song. I didn't think it was that great a song. And when the producer, Billy Sherrill, played me George's recording of it, I thought, wow, this is something really great. I think in this instance, the artist and the production elevated the song to a place that it wouldn't have been otherwise. I really attribute so much of the success of this to George Jones and his producer. Because after I heard it, I realized then that it was indeed something very special.
Now, you mentioned that you co-wrote the song with Curly Putman, who also co-wrote D-I-V-O-R-C-E. So what did he do on this song?
He did quite a bit. We had the song split up. He felt that I wrote more, and it was like two-thirds and a third. But, you know, if we had done this today, we would have split it right down the middle. As you look back on it, it's kind of a silly process of splitting songs up in strange increments like that, you know.
You're talking about splitting up the songwriting royalties.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think today we would, because when you look, because he and I wrote together quite a bit, and you look at a lot of songwriting teams, when you look at, like, Lennon and McCartney, there were so many songs that Paul wrote by himself and John wrote by himself.
No, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. And if I had to do it over, I think we would. And I've been in the situation, I wrote a song with Senator Throckmorton, a big hit called Thinking of a Rendezvous, and I just wrote the last verse, and I took a third of that. So I've been on both ends of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But Curly's contribution was I think it was major.
When we hear this, we'll hear a verse toward the end that is spoken. And tell us about how you wrote that part.
That part was not on the original song. The producer, Billy Sherrill, wanted us to have a verse, and I'm not sure we knew it was going to be a recitation, in which the departed's ex came to the funeral to see him one last time. And we did, I think, three or four versions of this before we got one that he, the producer, really liked. And that part of the song was written, I'd say, a year and a half, 2 years after the original draft.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's hear George Jones' He Stopped Loving Her Today, a song written by my guest, Bobby Braddock, with Curly Putman.
I went to see him just today. Oh, but I didn't see no tears. All dressed up to go away. First time I'd seen him smile in years. He stopped loving her today. They placed a wreath upon his door, and soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her today. You know, she came to see him one last time. Oh, and we all wondered if she would.
Bobby Braddock, the word schmaltz is probably not a word that's used a lot in country music, but it's a word. It's a word that comes to mind with parts of the song. Schmaltz being like overly sentimental, or you know, almost maudlin. Did you think this is really going to be over the top?
I think in the hands of anyone other than George Jones, it would have been really schmaltzy. And I think George had such an intense believability about it. There's a little story that goes with this, and I think it's okay to tell it, that as George was performing, in those days, the recordings were pretty much done. The vocals were often done with the band on the original tracking session, as opposed to now when they're done separately later on. And George had sung this once, and at that time his ex, Tammy Wynette, came into the control room with her new boyfriend, who was also a friend of George's, George Ritchie. And she sat down next to the producer, Billy Sherrill, in the control room, and Billy said, "George, you need to sing it one more time." And so as George sang it, he was looking in the control room, and Tammy's face was, I mean, Tammy Wynette, the love of George Jones' life at that time, her face was illuminated, and he was looking right at her as he sang that song. So I think that probably put a little more poignancy into what was going on that day.
That's the take you used, huh?
Mm-hmm. That's the take that we hear, yeah. He has his love of his life, Nancy, now. But at that time, this was like one of the great country music love stories, you know.
It must be so great to write a song and have it recorded by George Jones.
Well, it is. It's a great, great honor. I've had a lot of cuts by George Jones and Tammy Wynette, and that's, it was a big, big part of my career, and produced by Billy Sherrill.
Well, in fact, I want to play a song that another big hit for you that you wrote for George Jones and Tammy Wynette. And I'm sure a lot of people assume that when they sang together, their songs were autobiographical in some way. And here's a song you wouldn't confuse with that, because it's a couple who buys a ring from a pawn shop because that's all they can afford. And everybody knows that George Jones and Tammy Wynette could have afforded better than that.
That's right.
So tell us the story of the song before we hear it.
I got the idea for this song watching a made-for-TV movie. I don't remember the title, but it was an autobiography of a handgun, and it had belonged to a policeman. Someone stole it from him. It ended up in a pawn shop. Somebody bought it, And in the last scene, it showed a child reaching up and finding it and looking at it. And that's as far as it went. It didn't show what happened. But I thought that would be interesting to have a sort of an autobiography of a wedding band. And it didn't really turn into that, but that's sort of where it got started.
Well, let's hear Golden Ring, sung by Tammy Wynette and George Jones. This is written by my guest, Bobby Braddock, with Rafe Van Hoy, recorded in 1976.
In a pawn shop in Chicago, on a sunny summer day, a couple gazes at the wedding rings, their own display.
She smiles and nods her head as he says, "Honey, that's for you. It's not much, but it's the best that I can do."
Golden ring,
golden ring,
with one tiny little stone
waiting.
Just a cold metallic thing. Only love can make a golden wedding ring.
In a little wedding chapel later.
That was George Jones and Tammy Wynette singing Bobby Braddock's song Golden Ring. Braddock has written a new memoir called Down in Auburndale. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is country songwriter Bobby Braddock. His songs include D-I-V-O-R-C-E, He Stopped Loving Her Today, and I Believe the South is Gonna Rise Again. He's also written a new memoir about growing up in old Florida. It's called Down in Auburndale. Now, you were signed to Tree Music, which I think was probably the biggest country music publisher. Is that fair?
It was. It wasn't the giant then that it is now. And, of course, it is now Sony/ATV slash Tree.
Now, what was the approach of Tree Music to matching, well, to deciding whether a song was worthy of being recorded, and if so, who would be chosen to sing it, or who would be asked to sing it?
My memory is of just turning in a bunch of songs, them liking the songs, and getting out there on the street and getting them cut. They had, of course, a lot of good connections. My publisher, Buddy Killen, had a very close connection with Billy Sherrill, who was a budding producer, and eventually produced George Jones, Tammy Wynette, and Tanya Tucker, Barbara Mandrill, Johnny Duncan. So that was a very, very good connection. Buddy Killen himself was a very successful record producer, so my publisher produced a lot of these. So it was just pretty easy. There were not a lot of discussions about it. If they didn't like a song, they told me, you know, more than likely, the next song or two I brought them, there would be something they would like.
Did you ever think, oh, not him, don't give it to him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I thought that a lot. Yeah, and that still happens.
Do you say anything, or do you figure, well, maybe it'll be a hit anyways?
Yeah, I think maybe it'll be a hit anyway. And eventually, I became a song plugger myself and got quite a few, including the Toby Keith thing. I want to talk about me. I got that cut. And
what do you mean when you say you became a song plugger?
I just decided to go out and start pitching my own songs around.
Mm-hmm.
And I found this to be true. One hazard is that when I pitch songs myself, if there's a song they're not going to take, they're more apt to go ahead and tell me, yeah, we want that, because I'm sitting there in front of them, and then it doesn't get cut, so there's a disappointment. But the big plus to it is if I'm sitting there, they're going to listen to it all the way through, and they might hear something in it that they like that they wouldn't have heard if they had cut it off, if they were sitting there by themselves.
Good point. I'm glad you brought up the Toby Keith record. This is unusual because it's a kind of rap country song. So what gave you the idea to do that?
I think it's the only number one country rap song, you know. And they probably don't need to be anymore. I got the idea for that song, Terry, but I had a friend who I talked to quite a bit on the phone, and she was going through a lot of stressful personal things, and she's at that time she seemed to pretty much dominate the conversation with things that were going on in her life. And I wrote this song and played it to her on the phone, and she didn't say anything. And a day or two later, she called me up and she said, "That song you sing," she said, "did you write that about me?" And I said, "That's right." And so she was an inspiration to the song. And I was producing, had just begun producing a young man named Blake Shelton that I had a lot of success with producing in the past few years. And he went around doing this little rap thing just to cut up. And I thought it would be good to write a country song in rap form for him to record. And the record label thought, well, this wouldn't be a good first record for a new artist, and they were probably right. So then I took it to Toby Keith's producer, James Stroud, and he immediately liked it for Toby.
And he had a number one hit for 5 weeks.
For 5 weeks in a row, yeah. This probably as big a song as I ever had. It's probably as big as He Stopped Loving Her Today.
Why don't we hear it? That's Toby Keith, recorded in 2001. I Want to Talk About Me, written by my guest, Bobby Braddock.
We talk about your work, how your boss is a jerk. We talk about your church and your head when it hurts. We talk about the troubles you've been having with your brother, about your daddy and your mother and your crazy ex-lover. We talk about your friends and the places that you've been. We talk about your skin and the dimples on your chin, the polish on your toes and the run in your holes. And God knows we're gonna talk about your clothes. You know talking about you makes me smile. But every once in a while, I wanna talk about me, wanna talk about I, wanna talk about number one. Oh my, me, my, what I think, what I like, what I know, what I want, what I see. I like talking about you, you, usually. But occasionally, I wanna talk about me. I wanna talk about me.
That's Toby Keith from 2001, and my guest Bobby Braddock wrote that song. Bobby Braddock has a new memoir. It's called Down in Auburndale, A Songwriter's Youth in Old Florida, and it's about growing up in Central Florida. You know, a lot of people think of, like, George Jones country music and, say, Toby Keith country music as being two different forms altogether from two different eras of country music. You've, of course, had hits in both styles, both eras. Do you see that those two being as disconnected as some other people do?
I haven't really thought about it that much. Of course, sonically it's different because, for the most part, it's from different eras.
What are some of the sonic differences from the different eras?
For one thing, I can identify from different eras by the amount of reverb. Mm-hmm. And the amount of delay that they have on them, which are technical things. But stuff that you hear now, I'll tell you one difference now is singers are tuned. There are singers out there who do not have really good pitch, who probably could not have gotten deals years ago, who now, if they look good and if they have an interesting delivery and have an interesting personality, then they might get a record deal because their flatness or sharpness can be tuned by a digital process, Pro Tools. Toby Keith is not one of those. Toby live sounds pretty much like he does when he's recording. The attitude, Toby's got quite a bit of attitude, chutzpah. George comes from a different era, and it's more of a from the perspective of somebody maybe who does not have as much self-confidence this was an era when country music was about, she went off and left me, you know, my heart's broken. You're not as apt to hear that. I can't imagine Toby Keith saying, "Baby, you left me. I love you so much. Please come back to me." Country singers did a lot of that back in the 50s and 60s. You don't hear as much about that now. They inject themselves into the songs personally a lot, too. You know, you hear songwriters saying, well, I wouldn't say that. Thankfully, you don't hear a lot of actors saying, well, I wouldn't say that, you know.
And, well, that's the point. You're acting.
I know. Yeah. I know. So that's a big difference.
Yeah. So does it bother you when a singer says, I wouldn't say that, and you want to say to them, well, who cares? I'm the one who wrote it. Though I guess I'd have a right to feel it's not right for them. You know, that, yeah. They can't sing it sincerely.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Now, of course, I went through that whole thing in producing Blake Shelton. I saw a completely different side of it. And, you know, I was sitting on the other side of it and having to, and I hated that process. I mean, I loved it in a way, but what I hated about it was I was in a position of saying, no, well, we're not going to record your song. And I found that very, very hard. I found that painful. Every song I passed on, I felt bad about it because I had spent my entire life being on the other side of it.
My guest is country music songwriter Bobby Braddock. He's written a new memoir about growing up in old Florida. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is country music songwriter Bobby Braddock. His songs have been recorded by George Jones, Tammy Wynette, Tanya Tucker, and Toby Keith. So, you know, this whole idea that you can actually tune singers now, you can digitally change their pitch and make them on pitch. Does that bother you as a songwriter? Would you prefer to be have your songs interpreted by people who are just gifted singers and don't need that kind of technological fixing?
Tuning, that doesn't bother me so much. What does bother me is that I think to get a record deal now, somebody has got to be very handsome or very pretty. Mm-hmm. That bothers me because mm-hmm. I look back at some of the great singers, you know, they never would have gotten a deal today because aesthetically or cosmetically speaking, you know, I think they probably don't meet the standard of today.
And my goodness, I mean, even George Jones, it's not like, oh, what a hunk.
That's right. I mean, I've heard that said in retrospect about, say, for instance, Marty Robbins, mm-hmm. or Hank Williams, or Patsy Cline, or mm-hmm. or Kate Smith. You know, I think we would have missed out on a lot of good music, and we're probably missing out on a lot of good music now because they want people who are very video friendly.
What's one of your favorite songs of yours that we have not played?
My favorite song I've written that was a hit was Tracy Lawrence's record of Time Marches On. My favorite song that was not a hit was a song on a George Strait album. The song was called The Nerve, which was inspired by a book called Einstein's Dreams. It's a sort of physics put to music.
Why is Time Marches On one of your favorites?
I think of it as, I associate it with Auburndale in Polk County. I think I started thinking about this song as I would go down there and we're talking about the retirees moving in there. I would notice the difference in the old crackers, the natives, and the people who had moved down there from Illinois and Wisconsin and New Jersey. I know this sounds stereotypical and it may sound a bit bizarre, but I noticed that when Southerners get older, Southern men get older, their pants get lower and lower and lower, and their tummies stick out over their belt. Northerners, as they get older, their pants get higher and higher and higher till they finally wear them up to the chest area. And that inspired the bridge of that song, the South Moves North, the North Moves South, A Star Is Born, A Star Burns Out, which is actually I have in the front of my book.
Oh, that's great. Though I'm not completely sure that I would empirically agree with your conclusions about people in the North raising their pants above their belly, but it's an interesting theory.
It may be a little exaggeration, but I do have a flair for the dramatic.
You've proved that. Bobby Braddock, it's been great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Bobby Braddock has written a new memoir called Down in Auburndale, A Songwriter's Youth in Old Florida. This is the song we were just talking about, Time Marches On, sung by Tracy Lawrence.
Sisters using rouge and clear complexion soap. Brother's wearing beads and he smokes a lot of dope. Mama is depressed, barely makes a sound. Daddy's got a girlfriend in another town. Bob Dylan sings like a rolling stone. And time marches on. Time marches on. The South moves north, the North moves south. A star is born, a star burns out. The only thing same is everything changes, everything changes.
You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menjivar. I'm Terry Gross.
As the angels sing at old Hank Williams.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. From MPI Home Video, offering Beckett, starring Peter O'Toole and Richard Burton, restored and on DVD at beckettthemovie.com and in stores today. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Regent University School of Law was founded by televangelist Pat Robertson to bring a Christian perspective to the practice of law. One of its alumni, Monica Goodling, is at the center of the scandal involving the firing and replacing of U.S. attorneys. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with the dean of the Regent University School of Law. Join us.